Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is the first in the Commonwealth Club's Social Entrepreneurship in America series. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club. A social entrepreneur is an innovator utilizing entrepreneurial passion and rigor to solve societal problems. Throughout the series, a variety of perspectives will be shared that, taken together, will showcase much of the exciting and paradigm-shifting thinking from leading lights in the field. We would like to thank the W.K. Kellogg and Skoll Foundations and the Omidyar Network for their generous support of this series. No one exemplifies the thinking behind social entrepreneurship more than today's distinguished speaker, Dr. Muhammad Yunus. Dr. Yunus started his incredible journey with a $27 loan to a group of 42 women in his native Bangladesh. From this humble beginning, Dr. Yunus has created Grameen Bank, which now has become a group of companies, including those that focus on fisheries, agriculture, telecom, and clothing, in addition to microfinance. These various enterprises have changed the lives of millions, creating the opportunity for them to realize their potential in business and in education. The model has been successfully replicated around the world, including in the United States, creating a sea change on the way credit and finance was thought about and delivered to traditionally underserved populations. Dr. Muhammad Yunus, 2006 Nobel Laureate in Economics, founder of the Grameen Bank, and author of the new book, Building Social Business, The New Kind of Capitalism That Serves Humanity's Most Pressing Needs. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be back again. Thank you, Commonwealth Club, for inviting me back. I'm happy to go back and kind of update you what we have been doing in Bangladesh since we met last time. And today I'm especially honored to have the presence of Honorable Dr. George Shultz, who has become a legend in his own lifetime. And to see him in the audience kind of makes me nervous. But he has been watching our activities for a long time and has been guiding us in many ways, giving us advice on many issues. So we are very grateful that you could spare your time and come here. What we have been doing, just before we came in here, we're talking about starting a branch of Grameen in San Francisco. So this would be, hopefully will start this year. Probably you are aware that in the meantime, we started a program in New York City called Grameen America. And Grameen America started out in 2008 in January in Queens, Jackson Heights particularly, and gradually moved. The second branch was opened in Brooklyn and became equally successful. And about 10 days back, we opened the third branch in Manhattan, in Harlem. So we have three branches already working there. And seeing the exciting impact in the area that we are working in, Jackson Heights, someone invited us to do it in Omaha, Nebraska. So we started in Omaha, Nebraska. Now it's about 8 months there, it's working. So that was our fourth branch. And this year we are hoping to start fifth and sixth branch, one in San Francisco, another in Washington, D.C. So this would be something what we have been talking about for many, many years will become concrete right here in this particular situation. And as I was explaining to you about our work, I should remind you that we began a microcredit program, Grameen program in the United States back in 1987 at the invitation of Governor of Arkansas, Governor Clinton. So he invited us to do that, and we did that. The young girl who was responsible for this program, suddenly I saw her here before I entered this room. Julia Vendicius, is she here? Can you stand up, Julia? Yeah, let's give a big applause for her. She made the history because in 87, starting a Grameen program in Arkansas. So she is one responsible. She had never been to the South. She just came out of the university. And we thought she was just the right person to do that. And she took the challenge, went down to the South, and laid out the whole program. After many years, I see her here. I'm very delighted to meet her. As I mentioned, we started the program in Jackson Heights in January of 2008. At that time, we had no idea that January 8th, something big will happen in New York City, in financial sector. When it happened, it created a strange situation. Here in New York City, Grameen program is flourishing. People are taking money, paying back 100% without collateral, without guarantee, without any lawyers. On the other side of the road, the big banks with lots of collateral, lots of powerful lawyers were just melting away. So it tells you something, because when we began in 1976, as I was introduced with $27, and I was trying to persuade the bank located in the campus to give the loan to the poor women in the village so that they don't have to go to the loan sharks. Instead, they could take the money from the bank, and it's a very small amount of money. They wouldn't really feel a lot of a strain about it. Bank told me in a very harsh way that it cannot be done because poor people are not creditworthy. So I remembered it in 2008, later part of 2008, and I was asking a journalist, I said, I wish somebody would ask the question now, who is creditworthy? Is it these people without collateral paying back and the other side with lots of collateral, no paying back? So it's a kind of raises all these questions, and this crisis brings it out much more powerfully. The inner weakness of the banking system, that no matter what you talk about, with all your might, with all your power of collateral-based banking, you cannot just walk away saying that others without collateral are not creditworthy. It has not only in New York City, globally it's shown during this crisis, microcredit program has remained robust. In Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, we don't even know that there is a crisis going on because our our work goes on so smoothly. And many people ask me, why do you think it happens that way? I said, one reason I see right away, microcredit and Grameen Bank as a whole, is very close to the real economy. When we give a loan of $100 or $200, against that $200 or $100, there are some chickens, there are some baskets, there are some cattle or something. So it's a one-on-one relationship. So as long as that relationship remains with the real economy, you can't go wrong because you come back to that real economy. After all, money economy is something else based on the real economy. And that's why the impact on us is not felt, because we are based on the ground. We are solid on the solid ground. Other type of banking went wrong because they moved away from the real economy. They started building castle in the air, chasing papers, and a kind of artificial economy of speculation. So once this beautiful edifice of speculation, one piece fell apart, the whole thing fell apart. So that's the danger when you move away from the real economy to an artificially constructed system. All these problems raises issues very fundamentally, that the structure that we have, the architecture we have of the financial system and the entire economic system, something grossly flawed in it. We must not just gloss over and move on as if nothing happened. We'll make a big mistake if we do that. We have to look at it very carefully and redesign the system before we move on for future. Because if you leave things untouched, even if you create a quote-unquote normal situation, that normalcy will not last long, because you are following the same track and it will go to the same disaster again, maybe bigger one than we have right now. And financial crisis is not as one crisis. It's a combination of many crises. Other crises are not on the front page of the newspaper because it's not exciting news for many. Food crisis is still on. In 2008, if you recollect, food crisis hit whole world. Three governments fell, and there were street fights because of food shortages. Most of the food exporting countries closed their door that we are not going to sell our food anymore, because they were worried that their own people will go hungry while they can sell their food. Food importing countries got into such a terrible shape because they cannot buy from anywhere. All their lives they have been buying food and concentrating their business in other sectors. But suddenly exporting countries say, no, we are not going to sell. What do you do in a situation like that? So that crisis has not disappeared. Still on. And it will show its ugly face anytime in a way that it will shake the whole world. Energy crisis, again, 2008, if you recollect, oil prices went up to $150 a barrel. That energy crisis didn't disappear. Simply, it went down for a while, but it will come up because it's a fundamental issue of energy shortage. So that has to be in there too. And of course, the environmental crisis, which we have not done very much yet. Social crisis, poverty, diseases, and so on. So it's just an amalgam of all these crises. And it tells us one thing very clearly, that we have not designed our life and our system in which we perform our daily chores. It's not designed properly. Something is wrong in that. And I repeatedly point out this crisis and mega crisis that we have is just a great opportunity to undo the system and redesign it. Because when things work, you don't want to touch it because it's working. Since it's not working, this is a good time to really address it so that we go to a new normalcy, which will take us to a new path where we will not have all the problems that we created in the past. Now, going back to Grameen Bank, as I was updating you, we have been expanding within Bangladesh and also outside of Bangladesh in many countries, like in the United States. Within Bangladesh, we have over 8 million borrowers now, and 97% women. And the bank is owned by the borrowers, as usual. Bank makes profit. Profit goes back to the borrowers as dividend. So it's a complete circle. Nothing goes outside. And also it's a complete circle from another sense. We don't take any money from outside. We don't borrow from anybody. We don't take money from the government. We don't take money from international agencies. We lend out over $100 million a month in tiny loans, averaging less than $200 to over 8 million borrowers. So it's a lot of work, a lot of bookkeeping, a lot of tracking, and so on. But the fact is, all these 100 million per month over $1 billion per year, all this money, where does it come from? We don't take any money from outside. It's a very simple system. We take the deposits from people and we lend the money to the poor people. And it works out very well. We have over 2,600 branches with 27,000 plus staff. Each branch is responsible for finding its own money. It's not that one lucky branch supports 10 branches. It's not like that. We said every branch has to be self-sustaining. It's your money. It's your poor people around your neighborhood. And your task is to mobilize this deposit, lend the money to the poor women, and become self-sustainable yourself so that you don't be losing money in the branch. And that's the task. They perform it well, and they do it. And we don't have to worry about money as such. But that system, although microcredit has become popular around the world, everybody knows about it, there's a great respect for this idea. But this concept that we created in the Grameen Bank, that didn't take off because people are not creating new law to create a microfinance bank so that they can take deposits and lend money to the people. What is happening around microfinance, they're raising money, they're organizing foundations, put some money. Now, in the middle of it, investment funds became interested. They started investing money. I got very worried when investment funds started coming to lend money to the microfinance organization because I kept repeating that, look, we don't want to kind of excite people that here is a great opportunity to lend money to the poor people to make money for the rich people. I said poor people should not be presented as an opportunity for the rich people to make money. When we created microcredit, we didn't do it to make money for ourselves. We created it to fight the loan sharks so that we can give the loans to the poor women so that they can change their own life with their own efforts and come out of the poverty situation. That was the purpose. That's what the microcredit is all about. Microcredit is not something that should be taken as an opportunity for making money for somebody else. If it does that, then you move into the direction of the loan sharking, not in the direction of helping the poor to get out of it. So this is a constant debate. I try to present it, open it up for discussions. Within Grameen Bank, as I said, it's all owned by the poor people and it's a bank and we can do all this. We have also, not only we give loans to the poor people, we also make sure that children in Grameen families go to school. This is part of our mission. Because the families, all those 8 million families, are totally illiterate. Let me get a glass of water. They are totally illiterate. So we wanted to make sure the children do not repeat the same thing. The traditional cycle of poverty, illiteracy, disease in these families, which have been going on centuries, is not repeated to the next generation. That's what our intention. So we wanted to make sure all children go to school. So we promoted this, made it attractive to the borrowers. And since our borrowers are mothers, that was a big advantage for us. They understood this issue very clearly and supported it enthusiastically. They always said, the fate of my children should not be the same as my fate. I want to see my children have a better fate than I had. And that has supported an enormous amount of effort to take these children to school and keep them in school. So as a result, we have millions of these children in the schools. And we saw not only they came to school, they continued. And for the first time, we saw many years back the first generation of students coming to the university level, the college level. Up to high school, it's easy in Bangladesh because the entire education is free, provided by the government. But the moment you come to higher education, things change radically. Now you have to pay. So the poor people cannot pay. So they are wondering now that we have to quit education and go back to traditional peddling or selling things on the street and so on. So we immediately introduced education loan. Said, no, no way. You continue with your education as far as you can go. And Grameen Bank will give you all the money for education. And it became very popular. Kids loved it because now they can continue. Parents loved it because they have nobody to pay them or pay for them. So we have thousands and thousands of students in higher education, medical schools, engineering schools, universities. Right now, the one who are all right now in schools, in medical schools, engineering schools, and others, they number about 52,000. And the others who have graduated already in the professions and so on. There are many who have completed their PhDs. So it's a huge new generation that coming out of the illiterate families. One thing struck me when I first started hearing this way back. Young people, when I get to sit down together with them to see what their thinking is, what are their worries, what they want to do in future, always come up with the question that, yes, Grameen Bank has helped us to go into education. We are so grateful to Grameen Bank. But what about our jobs? Bangladesh doesn't have many jobs for us. So once we graduate, what do we do? How do we find our jobs? Can you help us find jobs? So after listening to that, I came up with another response. I said, look, whenever that question arises in this discussion, I said, look, you are very special kind of young people. We are very privileged young people because your mother owns a bank. So you have no shortage of money. Your mother would love to give you all this money to you so that you can move forward with your life. So money is not your problem. Why should you be looking for jobs? Why can't you think of something else? I said, why don't you think this way? And prepare that, follow that, and repeat this as a pledge in your life. Every morning you get up, you repeat this. You tell yourself, I'm not a job seeker. I'm a job giver. This is my job. So my mission is to create jobs for others. I said, that's what you should be doing. Rather than chasing job, everybody's chasing one single job. One gets it, everybody else is rejected from it. That's not a good prospect for a young person. Young person should be looking forward, create the new world for yourself, rather than wasting yourself in chasing one tiny little job here and one tiny little job there. In the beginning, they were really scared. How can I create jobs when I don't have a job myself? So that's kind of contradictory to them. So seeing that, I started telling them, look, when you get disheartened, when you lose your spirit that you don't know what to do, you look at your mother. What she did. She started her life with Grameen Bank some 15 years, 20 years back. When she took her first loan, it was probably $30 or $35. She was scared to death taking these $35 loans. She was shaking. She couldn't hold herself still because such an enormous amount of money is given in her hand. She was so nervous about it. But she assembled her courage, fought for it, and made it a success, paid back the loan, earned enough money. And since then, she is doing that. Her loans have become bigger and bigger. In the meantime, you are born. She sent you to school, made sure you stay in school. Today, you are in a medical school. Today, you are in an engineering school. What good is your education if you are not better than your illiterate mother? She could take the uncertainties in her control, being an illiterate village woman, and she succeeded. Your education should have given you a much broader perspective to fight it in a much better way. You are talking about ideas. How did she get her ideas? If you are looking for examples, you have examples right in your home. Your mother is an example. So why can't you create a business 10 times bigger than what your mother does today? Because you have education. You can easily expand it to 10 times, 50 times, 100 times bigger. That's the beginning. In the meantime, you can think of other businesses. So gradually, many students are coming up to take kind of loans and starting their own enterprises. I said, start a small enterprise. It doesn't have to be big. So that by the time you finish your education, you have your smaller enterprise is still there. And now you can make it big because you have gone through the teething stage. Now you have done this. You are ready for the whole thing. So they are taking it seriously. And I feel happy that when I talk about them, they are not as nervous they used to be. So this is another way to look forward to create something that they see is they are capable of doing that. When you talk to these young people, it's an amazing feeling because I speak to many student groups in the universities everywhere, in the USA, in Europe, in many other countries. I see no difference between these young people who are in the universities, coming from the extremely poor families. You talk to them, you look at them, they have the same kind of ambitions, same kind of feelings about their future and so on. But they happen to be coming from the extremely poor families. So looking at them, you know, you feel that poverty is not really created by those individuals. Neither their mother has created it, she has created it. It is created by somebody else. And poverty is imposed on those people. It's not something grown out of them. It is imposed by external factors. And I try to explain it by saying that poverty is created by the system. And for system, I say, look at the institutions which behave very wrongly with the poor people, like financial institutions, saying that, no, you're not good enough for our service, and rejected massively half the population of the world, saying that you're no good. And when we are doing it in New York, and a journalist asked me, I think this is a good point to mention that. So I talked to Eunice, what do you see in this work that you are doing in this tiny work in New York City, in Harlem or Jackson Heights? I said, look, this is tiny, but gradually it's growing from one branch, second branch, third branch, it will grow. And someday, hopefully, we'll do all over New York City. Everybody will have access to this because it's open for everybody. And our success will be measured by the time we'll do this, finish it. There'll be no payday loans in New York City. And New York City will be the first city in this country which doesn't have any payday loans because it's not needed. Because we take care of all their needs. This is what the microcredit is all about. I said, by the time we are finished doing this, there'll be no check cashing company in New York City. It's gone, finished. I said, New York City will be the first city in the whole of the United States where you will not see a sign called pawn shop. It will be gone, finish. I said, these are scar of the faces of a nation to see the payday loans, to see pawn shops, to see check cashing companies. It's ill health. That something is wrong. Otherwise, why should people have to force to pay 500% interest rate, 1,500% interest rate to borrow a small amount of money? It doesn't make sense. So I said, this is the thing that system forced them to be what it is. It's an institutional failure. And I also mentioned conceptual failure. And I particularly point out the conceptual failure of the concept of business. I said, look, in the entire capitalist system, the concept of business has one meaning. Business to make money. Profit maximization is the mission of that business. I said, that sounds very good. I have no quarrel with that. But to say that's what all human being does is something unacceptable to me. It presents human being in such a narrow way, as if human beings are a one-dimensional being. All they do in their business life is make money, nothing else. I said, real human beings are multidimensional. But the economists didn't recognize the multidimensionality of human being. Took one piece of human being and built the whole theory out of it. And that's what the problem that we created. Other parts of human being are excluded. I said, we are selfish as a human being because it comes out of our necessity of self-protection. That's where the starting point of selfishness. And it is a basic ingredient of in all human beings. Similarly, there's another ingredient which is as basic as the other one, selflessness. We are also selfless beings. When we see somebody in a distress, we jump out, try to help. And I gave the example of Haiti. I said, when Haiti earthquake happened, hardly anybody left who didn't say, let's give them something to help them. People wrote checks, gave cash, students raised money to help them. We don't know who they are. We have never met them. But outpouring of emotions to help other people comes out. In tsunami, if you remember, the whole world was kind of pouring out everything because of the distress they were in. This is part of us. I'm not saying there are some selfish people, some selfless people. No, that's not my argument. I'm saying every single human being is packed with these elements of selfishness and selflessness at the same time. Economists build business on the basis of selfishness. In that business, everything is for me, nothing for others. I said, why don't we make another business? Business on the basis of selflessness. Everything is for others, nothing for me. So we can do both. We can do business to make money. We can use the money to change the world. That's a selfless business. We want to solve problems. Then I started promoting this idea that let there be another kind of business. Business of, based on selflessness. I'm not saying the other business, conventional business should be closed down. That's not what I said. Let conventional business flourish as they flourish. We can fix them a little bit whenever we see something wrong in it, but basically let them function and let them grow. At the same time, we open another door. If you want to address a particular problem, we can create a business to solve the problem. So it's a problem-solving business. Not money-making business. In that business, I invest for the cause that I believe in so that I can eliminate that problem forever in a business way. Today, this is done through philanthropy. The distinction between philanthropy and social business is, in philanthropy, you give the money, achieve the goal, which is an important goal, but the money never comes back because that was not the intention of it. I said, if I can design a business to address the same issue, same problem, in a business way, then money comes back. Same money will recycle again and again and again and achieve so much. And you created an institution which is subject to now improvements, enhancements, and so on and so forth. We learn from each other, looking at each other. An enormous opportunity opens up. In the beginning, people didn't pay much attention to it. We started creating these companies, social business companies in Bangladesh. People started noticing us suddenly when we did a joint venture with a big company, Danone. Then they said, what are they doing? Why Danone should be doing this? Are they crazy? We know this guy is crazy, so let him do it. But why Danone? They started looking at it very carefully. Came out with a lot of explanation. But what we did jointly with Danone came out with enthusiasm, not that Danone was persuaded into doing this. Actually, this was a very spontaneous step from Danone to get involved in this. We created a social business in Bangladesh, creating a company called Grameen Danone Company. We produce yogurt. Danone is very good in producing yogurt. But this is a very special kind of yogurt. This whole company is dedicated to address the malnutrition among the children. Bangladesh has millions of children. We have a total population of 150 million. And all these children, 50% of these children are malnourished. Most of them are severely malnourished. And when the child is malnourished, and most of them are malnourished, you don't have a future for the nation. Because malnourishment means your growth becomes stunted, physical growth becomes stunted, your mental growth becomes stunted. That's not a good news for a nation who want to build young minds and create the whole future on the basis of their creativity. Your starting point is wrong. And lots of efforts have been done in the past to address that, but nothing really worked. Not in a way that it will make a general impact. So we thought, why don't we try to do it in the social business way? We put all the micronutrients into the children, into the yogurt, vitamin, iron, zinc, etc., and started selling this yogurt very cheap. And then children love it. If a child eats 2 cups of this yogurt within a week and continues to do so for 8 or 9 months, the child gets back all the micronutrients. The child becomes healthy, playful child. And the growth of the child becomes like a normal growth of a child. Mother loves to see that child jumping around. She has a hard time controlling him or controlling her. She feels so good. And instead of child sitting there, always crying, doing nothing. So she can immediately recognize that. So this is the purpose of the company. The owners of the company can take back the investment money, but they will never take any profit out of it because this is dedicated to the cause. So I said, why don't we create all those cause-driven companies? And we started doing that. Many other companies came forward to do it. So we have a series of these companies now. And we see possibility. Young people are taking a lot of interest. And that's what the subject matter of my book, to tell you the stories about what happened since then, since I elaborated the idea of social business in my previous book. And in many universities, they are creating an institute of social business. Many universities, they are creating chairs of social business so that they can be taught as a courses and academic curriculum and so on. Many are trying to put up centers of social business in Europe, USA, in the State University of California, in Channel Island. They created the Institute of Social Business. So right here in this state, it's already there. And many other universities in Japan, they are doing that. So I see good response both from the business area and also from the young people's area. So this can mix together. We have enormous amount of technology in the world today. If we can bring our creative minds to use this technology to change our problems, all the problems that we have piled up over years, these problems will disappear in no time if we do it in a business way. So that's the challenge that we all have, and that's what we're looking for, how to bring out that creativity in each individual, each one of us, rather than waiting for the government to solve everything, rather than waiting for the international agencies to solve the problems of the world. We are much better as individual. We can create much more dynamic and much more creative things to solve the problems which were never solved before. And that's what social business empowers us to do. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Muhammad Yunus, 2006 Nobel Laureate in Economics, founder of the Grameen Bank, author of the new book, Building Social Business, the New Kind of Capitalism that Serves Humanity's Most Pressing Needs, and inspiration clearly to all of us for his comments this afternoon. It's now time for our audience question period, and we have a number of questions.
Okay.
In various categories. So I've put them together, and I'm going to aggregate them for you.
Okay.
There's a number of questions about the business model behind both social business and behind Grameen Bank traditionally, especially vis-a-vis bottom of the pyramid thinking. So I wonder if you could just give us a very quick primer on the different models that you've crafted over the years, social business, Grameen lending, et cetera, and how the group can kind of get an understanding, a quick understanding of those.
Yeah. Grameen Bank and social business. They are, one is the offshoot of the others. We started with Grameen Bank, but we got involved with many, many other companies. In the process, we created almost 40 different companies with Grameen name into it. Grameen Shakti or Grameen Energy, Grameen Phone, Grameen IT Company, Grameen Solutions, Grameen Textile, you name it, lots of them. You'll see them. Always, whenever I see a problem that I want to address, I want to solve, I create a business. I create a company. I think creating a company to solve the problem, it makes, to me, makes much more sense because I can handle it. Through that business, I can address it. When I saw that information technology is such a powerful thing happening in the world, if we can somehow bring this technology to the hands of the poor people, poor women particularly, the world will change dramatically. Poverty will take care of itself. People will overcome this poverty because now they are the master of their fate. So I was looking for opportunity, and that opportunity came, and I created the company, a Grameen phone, a mobile phone company. And it became a very successful mobile phone company, bringing mobile phone into the villages and giving them in the hands of the poor women to run business with their phones. So this is one. And many other such companies we created. One thing, when we defined social business, the idea of social business grew from that, that I've created all those companies, and people think that I'm a very rich man. I have so many companies. And I try to explain, look, I created all those companies, but I'm not a rich man. Then they get very puzzled. Why you have so many companies, but still you say you're not a rich man? Don't you own all these companies? I said, no, I don't own any one of these companies. Then why do you create companies if you are not owning them? I said, it never crossed my mind that I have to own it. I created them to solve problems. I was not thinking of owning them. I don't own a single share in any of the companies that I've created. That puzzles them. So then I realize what I've actually done, I created a new class of business. Unlike the conventional business, the way our mind works, that we have to make money, you have to be rich, that was not my intention. So I said, why don't I put them in the context, see how it looks. That's what the social business idea came. And that's a business where you don't make money. You own it, but don't make money. You don't take any profit because it's dedicated to that. What about Grameen Bank? Does Grameen Bank make profit? Do the owners make money? Yes, it does. Because Grameen Bank is owned by the poor people. Then I gave the second definition of social business. I said any business which is owned by the poor people, even if it is a profit-making company, even if they are taking dividend, that's a social business because it's collectively owned by the poor people. So that's a second definition of social business. So today, Grameen Bank is a social business, and all other companies that I'm creating now are social business because these are all dedicated to solving the problem. Either it's a healthcare, or it is something, housing or whatever, that's a social business because of the way we have defined social business.
There's a number of questions about the profit aspect of business, and they range from those companies, those lending companies that you addressed earlier that are in effect gouging the consumer and getting a lot of interest back for microloans. And they also talk about, there's a number of questions about, is it okay for large multinational corporations to get involved with microfinance? So what's the role, what's the legitimate role, I suppose, of profit-making ventures in addressing social issues?
Yeah. The way our idea of microcredit developed was to help people so that they can, they do not have to live with the life with loan sharks. They can get rid of loan sharks and get a loan with reasonable interest rate so that their life is better off. But the idea when it became popular, it's started being misused, sometimes even abused. Even doing loan sharking, calling themselves as microcredit. So I said, look, payday loan people are doing great work. They're lending money to the people, very small amount of money, which others will not give them. But should you call them microcredit? Should you call them they're doing great work? No, I wouldn't. I said they are the loan sharks. That's what the fight is, so that we can create another kind of business where you don't have to take things away from people, rather than leave it to them so that they can change their own life. So that's the line one has to draw. Up to what extent it is legitimate microcredit, and beyond which it becomes loan sharking. So whether it's this being done by a rich multinational or a poor individuals, doesn't matter. It's what you do that matters. If it is a rich multinational is doing social business microcredit, we applaud them. They are doing great work. If a poor person is lending money to make money out of the poor people, then I would say it's a loan sharking. We don't accept it. So this is, it's not who does it. It is what they do. That's what makes the difference.
There's a group of questions that addresses policy, especially government policy. Someone seems to know that you're going to meet with President Obama tomorrow.
No. I'm far away from it. Is he here? Well, I don't know.
He hasn't informed me of his plans. regardless of that, yeah. What is it that governments can do to facilitate more people getting involved with business and getting access to credit? And also, what should government be doing in terms of its development assistance to help those in emerging markets? So two parts, domestic policy and international foreign policy.
Yeah. So far as the conventional business is done, I'm sure we all know what the government is supposed to do. If it is related to what government can do to promote social business, yes, there are a lot of things government can do. Create social business fund so that anybody who wants to do social business, he or she can go to the fund and say, here are my social business idea. Would you give us investment money so mm-hmm. that we can invest? Would you be my co-investors so that government money can come as a co-investing money because you are solving a problem? For example, somebody said, okay, I have a great idea. I'm going to create a social business. I would like to take 10 people out of welfare through a social business. I create a business to take people out of welfare. And I need X amount of money to do that as an investment, which gradually I'll pay you back because that's a business that you pay back. But in the meantime, I'll take these 10 people out of welfare completely. So this fund is available. If the government fund is available, they will go and say, give us the money as an investment. This is what the proof, this is what we'll do. And government should support it because, after all, government is paying these people from its own budget all the time.
Does that fund exist anywhere that you
know?
No,
this social business idea doesn't exist.
Oh, okay.
So this is the new idea.
Okay.
So with new idea, new things will come at the fund. Now the funds are being created. I have given a list of those funds in the book also, those who are already created or in the process of being created. So these funds can be created. Like you talked about their government assistance in international arena of development, foreign aid. I said foreign aid money goes to the government and goes to the agencies and does it feel happy, unhappy, and so on. I said, why don't you create a social business fund out of this foreign aid in each country where you're giving the money? Mm-hmm. If you take 10% of that money, separate it out, whatever you're giving as a foreign assistance, to create social business fund so that the people in the country and outside the country can come and create social businesses to address healthcare. Healthcare is an excellent social business idea that you can solve the problems of healthcare by creating social businesses, or forestry, or education, or environment, renewable energy, as a social business. So this fund could be used. Then this fund becomes bigger and bigger, because it doesn't disappear. Because each year you're putting more money, it becomes bigger. The money that you give, it comes back again, it becomes bigger. Foreign aid that goes never comes back. At the end of the day, it becomes zero. Mm. So again, start all over again with the fresh money. So this is better. You're taking only 10% of the money. If you think this is doing good work, you can gradually may think of making a bigger one. A state government or a city government, a state government can do the same. Create social business funds, encourage the citizens to participate in solving the problem, to take drug addicts out of drug, could be done as a social business, mm-hmm. or taking advantage, taking care of the disabled people, right. could be a social business. So we can help, we can invest and do that. Foundations can do that, create social business fund. So these are the kind of ways one can come forward and support that.
Yep. There are several questions about this. Well, most people are focused on what's happening in the United States. And you have spent your career trying to make credit available. Many people would argue in this country there's been too much credit available and we don't know how to save. Is that something, could you address?
Well, I was just giving examples. The existence of payday loans doesn't create the impression that there's too much credit going on. Mm-hmm. If there's too much credit going on, this will be closed down. This right. There's no business left. Pawn shops and all these is an indication. You may say too much credit going on in one direction with some people, mm-hmm. but others are credit-starved people. So, and I talk about the credit-starved people. I'm not talking about the people who have lots of credit. And when I'm talking about credit, I'm not talking about consumer credit, which is, again, a way to make money for somebody else, consumer credit. I'm not talking about consumer credit. I'm right. talking about the investment money, money to generate income for themselves.
Right.
That money is not there. It doesn't exist.
Could you address what Grameen America is doing in terms of making credit available, and what are the kinds of businesses that people are taking loans out for? It's still early days, but what have you learned so far?
Well, it's already 2.5 years. Lots of people take, well, about over 3,000 people have taken loans, all mm-hmm. women. Mm-hmm. Common things that I can remember, hairdressing salon. You rent a chair and become a hairdresser. Mm-hmm. You used to work for some hairdresser before, but you lost your job. You have the skill, you have everything, but you have no money. So given the money, now you can rent out a chair and become a hairdresser salon. Mm-hmm. Or you used to work for a house cleaning company, and now you don't have a job. So you start a business of house cleaning on your own, you take a loan, you get the equipment and supplies, you contract and you do the business yourself. Daycare center is another popular item in New York City. She has her own children. Now several other children come. She has a business for her own, take care of the children. Pet care, dogs, cats, and right. all that. Well, taking care of them is a good business. Bakery, personal bakery, making cakes, breads, and mm-hmm. so on. That's another one. Jewelry, that's another one. So there are lots of things people do. People are already involved in it. Simply that money doesn't exist for them, so they cannot either continue with it, or they used to work for a company, now they don't have the money to run the business on their own. So this is how they try to work it out.
There's about 10 people in the audience who want to volunteer or work for Grameen America.
Wow. Well, love that. Grameen America, why not all those places, particularly in San Francisco, since it's coming. So we'll be very delighted to talk to you.
Okay, you heard that. And then there's a whole group of questions about you. You are an inspiration to all of us, and we thank you very much for that. But let's go back to your early days. Part of your message here and part of the goal of the series on social entrepreneurship is to inspire people. Now you're already so well known, but if you can remember back to convincing people, to the times when not everyone knew who you were and what your ideas were, maybe you could discuss some of the challenges you faced and how you overcame them so that we could learn from those.
Yeah. My way of doing things always is not about talking. I always do the doing. I do it, and that's why people find it attractive. If I talk about social business, had never done a social business in my life, nobody would care what it is. But mm-hmm. when I talk about social business, I say, this is what I've done. It makes sense to me. Probably it makes sense to you, too. Then say, it's really true. And many people come to visit Bangladesh just to see them. Because seeing is a more exciting thing than talking about it. People get very excited. They want to do it themselves and so on. So this is how even microcredit. So we didn't say, let's think about something that will give credit to the women. That's not how we did. Actually, we said, I don't know anything whether it will happen or not, but let me try. So I tried it and worked. And people said, well, you can do it in one village, but it will never work in two villages because it's too big and it will collapse. I said, okay, let me try again. So we did it in two villages. It worked. The manager, bank manager, who was waiting to have the whole thing collapse, he said, maybe you should try it in five villages. Because one village and two villages are the same thing. It's not big enough. I said, okay, let me try over five villages. So I did it over five villages. Even then, I didn't know that it should really work out. Mm-hmm. But it worked out. So that's how it continued to be big. And then people said, well, it may happen in Bangladesh. Bangladesh is a funny country anyway. It will never happen in any other country. Then another country started doing it, Malaysia. Then I said, look, there's another country is doing it, Malaysia. Oh, it must be something about Muslim country. See, people don't give up. They always find something to give their arguments. Then came Philippines. This is not a Muslim country. It's a Catholic country. Yes. Then say, well, it's an Asian culture. Probably. Then came Arkansas.
Oh, right.
So this is how people always explaining way. Even when it happened in Arkansas, it happened in Chicago, it happened in South Dakota, it is spread from Arkansas to many other places. Still people say, no, it don't work here because these are not sustainable. So that debate went on. And I said, look, it can be worked. Simply it's a question of doing it right. If you do it right, everything is possible. So we were challenged. A friend of mine said, okay, I'll provide the money. You can show us. So he took the challenge, and we took the challenge, and we started doing it in New York City, in Jackson Heights. Mm-hmm. So this is how come it's working beautifully. Repayment is good. Interest rate is low. And we are moving towards self-sustainability. So this is one. And now we are moving into other direction, other places and so on. So there are oppositions come from the mindset. People love to believe what they believe. They don't want to see something different. Then they reject it right away. And they keep on arguing that it's not right. And it takes a lot of time to change the mind. And our mindsets are created in our educational institutions. That's where we develop our mindsets. So their educational institutions become so important. What kind of ideas you bring? Can the students remain open-minded to absorb new ideas? How to do that? So creating students with a rigid mindset, I think, is a damaging thing to do because then you are sealing it off. Mm-hmm. It cannot take any other fresh idea. We live in a world today, continuously new ideas are generated. If you cannot cope with our education system to absorb these new ideas, and even if these ideas are challenging and throwing out our old ideas, we have to absorb them. Otherwise, we'll be damaging to ourselves and our society. So these are the things. Like, people couldn't believe that we can give loans to women. One most frequently asked question to me everywhere in the world, why so many women? I said, did you ever ask anybody, any organization, why so many men?
I have.
You never.
There's questions about what it takes to be a social entrepreneur and a social innovator. Tenacity, as you just said, is one of them. What are the characteristics of a person who's going to bring about social change or start a social business?
Well, I guess others will have to find out. I cannot tell. I only see something that if I see a problem, my instinct is I can solve the problem. At least I can try. So I start trying, and usually I try it in a business way. So if it is a healthcare, I create health insurance, health system. If it doesn't work, I find out the existing thing that I used is the wrong thing. Like, for example, now we are creating social business in healthcare, starting with the diagnostic services. We want to bring diagnostic services at home, at every home, in the villages, so that we don't have to send people to clinics for diagnostic services. So we saw that existing equipments doesn't allow us to do that. It's too heavy, too bulky, too expensive. Then we're saying your equipments are wrong. Right. You created all those bulky, expensive equipments just to make sure you can write a big check to your patients so that they can pay you more and they're impressed how to, big machine you have to use for this. I said, this whole machine could have been in a shoebox because there's nothing else but few chips, that's all. Mm-hmm. So why don't we go back to that chips and simple diagnostic tools as efficient as any other bulky machine that you have in your clinics and hospitals. Right. So we're designing that and we are collaborating with manufacturers who are doing that, that they also support the idea. So we are coming back to that. So we are bringing those equipments at the village, like, for example, pregnancy. So we have designed, in collaboration with General Electric, they designed actually, in consultation with us, a simple ultrasonic, so that a girl will carry it house to house with the pregnant mothers, take the images, and doctor is nowhere here. All these images will be transmitted to the doctors in the city, big city, who will be sitting in front of the screen, and all these images will transfer to the mobile phones into that screen. So your expert is watching you, and you are talking to the experts of the mobile phone, so the distance has not created any problem for us. This can become very inexpensive way of providing health services. If you can bring the diagnostic services, bulk of your problem will be solved. Because in our case, with the way we have designed our healthcare program, we said keeping healthy people healthy is our major objective. Mm-hmm. So awareness and prevention and all those things becomes our major. Then women becomes our highest priority. Children become the second priority. Adolescent girls become the third priority. So people ask me, why do you always go for women? Well, I always try to explain that these are the most difficult segment of population to reach. Mm. Once you can reach these people, then reaching other people is so easy. It's no problem at all.
Well, even though you always go for women, there's one question that wants to know what your experience being a Boy Scout meant to you in terms of being a social entrepreneur.
I don't know. At that time, I was not thinking about being a social entrepreneur. I enjoyed being a Boy Scout. Because I traveled a lot as a Boy Scout. Yeah. That was a great opportunity. I participated in the 8th World Jamboree in Canada.
Yes.
Niagara on the Lake.
The questioner knows that.
Yeah. So that was a fascinating thing. And a 15-year-old discovering the world, coming to Canada, coming out of Bangladesh. And then traveled through whole Europe by microbus. And took us 6 months to go through Europe. Because we wanted to go wherever we wanted to see. We were in no hurry to go back home. So that was an enormous experience by itself. Yeah.
We have time for one last question, Dr. Yunus. And you started your talk talking about all the various crises that are going on in the world. The last question is, what really keeps you up at night still?
I see the possibility that these all can be overcome. Human being has enormous capacities, are packed with unlimited capacity. It's a question of unleashing this capacity. So we did some stupid things. We did some wrong things. That's what created all this problem. It's not that it is something unalterable. It's something as if it comes from the heaven. You cannot change. It's not. We created this mess. We can clean up this mess.
Well,
we have the capacity to clean up this mess. That's the only thing I think. So I feel good about it.
That's a great way to end, I think.
Thank you. Thank you.
I think you're going to get another standing ovation. Our thanks to Dr. Muhammad Yunus, 2006 Nobel Laureate in Economics, founder of the Grameen Bank, and author of the new book, Building Social Business, The New Kind of Capitalism That Serves Humanity's Most Pressing Needs. We want to thank our audience here on the radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been the first in the Commonwealth Club's Social Entrepreneurship Series. I look forward to seeing you all at the remaining 12 programs. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.